I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Scott Vestchuk joins me now. The noted humorist and columnist has a new book out, The Future and Why We Should Avoid It. It's a laugh-out-loud funny book. He looks ahead to all the awful things that we can expect in our politics, our technology, our bodies, and more, and warns us about why we should steer clear of whatever Apple might come up with next or the zombies that'll run for president in 2052. Scott Vestchuk's two previous books were Searching for Michael Jackson's Nose and How Not to Completely Suck as a New Parent. He's an award-winning humorist who's a columnist at Maclean's and who's also written for Sportsnet, The Globe and Mail, This Hour Has 22 Minutes, and The National Post, where, like a lot of people, I first became acquainted with his trenchant wit. Mr. Vestchuk was also a chief speechwriter for Paul Martin when Martin was Prime Minister of Canada. The Twitter handle is at Scott Vestchuk. The book is published by Douglas and McIntyre. Please welcome to the Plant Online program from Ottawa today, Scott Vestchuk. Mr. Vestchuk, good morning.
Hi, Joe. How are you?
Pretty good. Yourself?
Great, thanks.
So were you with Paul Martin the whole time that he was Prime Minister?
I joined shortly after he was sworn in, probably about a month later, but was with him till the end, which didn't come that much later.
Yeah. Were you the one who came up with the idea at the...
I'm already feeling like an ambush in every 60 minutes. Are you the one to blame?
No, well, the one of the funnier moments in the last 15, 20 years or so was the at the press gallery dinner where Brian Mulroney filmed that piece.
Wow, yes, I'm not sure many people would be familiar with that beyond the press gallery itself, but yeah.
I remember watching that night on I guess, CTV Newsnet, and what it was I guess, Peter C. Newman had just published a book, The Secret Mulroney Tapes.
That's right.
Where it was revealed for a lot of people that Mulroney swore a lot, and so Paul Martin introduces this film, and were you the one who came up with that, though?
I have to admit I was.
Yeah, well, it was great, a great piece of film. Would you tell people about that?
Sure, yeah, absolutely. So the press gallery dinner is something that most leaders do not look forward to because the odds of bombing are much higher than the odds of doing very well because you're expected to be funny, and if you're not, people can be rather merciless. It used to be very much an off-the-record type environment, but now they put it on TV. So the stakes are a little bit different and the pressure is a little bit higher. And the Secret Mulroney Tapes was a really big story at the time, this whole notion that Peter C. Newman had recorded this stuff and kind of without Mulroney's, explicit permission, typed it all up and printed it as a book.
Yeah.
So my idea was we went to Montreal. At the time, Mulroney was in poor health and had actually just started back at work the day we did the filming. So he was kind of frail, but I have to say he loved the idea, which was basically... a very long build-up. He would say that we would introduce him with the Prime Ministerial logo, former Prime Minister of Canada. He'd be seated in a formal environment. There'd be a big build-up. He'd go like party leaders, members of Parliament, Supreme Court justices, and this would go on for about a minute.
Yeah.
And then at the end of it, he goes, Peter C. Newman, go fuck yourself. Good night. Yeah. And then it fades out, and that's the end of the whole. The whole speech is just that. And the big debate we got into him with was, would he actually swear on camera? Or would we have to kind of fake it and blame it? And it was, I think it may have been, just a factor of his health at the time and his mentality about the Ottawa Press Gallery. He kept saying to me, if I swear, if you have me saying that, they're just going to be all over me. So in the end, he did swear, but he made us bleep it.
Yeah.
But it wasn't any less funny. He was a great sport for doing it.
Yeah, I was just thinking about that when I mentioned the line in your bio that you'd work for Martin, because that was one of the, I guess Harper doesn't do these press gallery dinners anymore.
Or maybe he does, and it's a shame because he's incredibly good at them.
Yeah.
He's got one of his things that he does, or used to do when he actually attended them, was he did impressions.
Yeah.
Of John McCallum, who was a former Liberal cabinet minister, was probably his best, but he did a variety of people.
Like
he was wildly entertaining, and whoever wrote his stuff, and I think actually I'm sure he had a hand in it, was just bang on. His stuff was always really good.
Yeah. Being funny is hard, and I guess the flack that politicians get, people like Harper, is that they're not funny enough. But I guess we don't really want to goof being prime minister, but we tend to get some sometimes.
They make the calculation, I think, pretty early that the risk and the downside of being humorous outweighs the benefits. So a lot of them will be, you know, I thought Paul Martin, for instance, was extremely funny when he was doing his own little self-deprecating bit off the top.
Mm-hmm.
But he was really reticent about doing any sort of jokes or anything like that, as he probably should have been. And when he ended up doing them, he didn't really sell them very well and didn't work very well. But when he was just being himself, he could actually get a lot of laughs.
So
I think you'll find.
Yeah.
I think we find that a lot of, you know, you see what's happening with Trudeau, and it's not quite the same thing. He's a guy who maybe speaks his mind a little too much. He muses on things. I think that one comment he made about, you know who is an efficient government is China. You know, it's just something that, you know, maybe people would think, but a person might not say, and that's not quite a joke, obviously. He wasn't quite, you know, telling a joke. But it's the same mindset where once you get burned by talking like that or telling a couple jokes that backfire, then all of a sudden it's just not something you're interested in trying anymore.
So it just seemed odd that someone who is a humorist like yourself, and who I assume has been funny since you were a kid, would go into, say, politics.
And to the extent that there were any stories about it when I did that, they were all about, well, they've hired Scott Vestrick to make this guy funny. And, of course, that was not at all the case. I was just looking to try something that was different. I started in journalism at the Globe and later at the National Post as a kind of serious reporter. I worked in the business department at the Globe and wrote a business column and all that. So I kind of didn't, I mean, I really enjoy writing humor, and that's what I think I'm best at. But it wasn't the only thing I thought I was half decent at, so I wanted to try something new.
And so, is it, I mean, being funny, I mean, that's obviously your job, part of your job now. Do you know that? And I mean, like, or did someone have to tell you, hey, Scott, that's a funny observation you have? And it's obviously something you have to work at. It's silly to talk about humor this way, but...
No, I think you actually touched on a good point, which is basically that there's times that you think you've written something that's, you know, funny, and it gets very little reaction, or it just kind of goes by unnoticed. And then there's times that you think you just phoned one in, and it gets way more reaction, and people do think it's funny. So it remains kind of elusive and mysterious, I have to say. And of course, now in the world of social media, you're never far from knowing what people actually think about it. And a good example of kind of what I'm saying is, so there's an audience that I have in McLean's, and they know what to expect from me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that generally the people who read me in McLean's, those who don't like me have probably decided not to read me anymore. So I get a lot of fairly positive comments. My column occasionally will also run at yahoo.ca for some reason. I don't really understand how the mechanics of that work. And the reaction there is usually much more, like, people are just baffled by what I write, or they think it's incredibly unfunny, or whatever. You know, it's just a very different, it's a different audience, and they have a different, I guess, expectation of what should be in a kind of a news environment. So it's just funny. You can never really, I guess, predict or hope to understand what people will truly think of as funny. You can just do your best and see what happens.
And so what's the measure, then, if you write something about Tim Hortons, as you frequently...
My measure is continued employment. I have no other measure.
I
honestly don't. So long as somebody keeps paying me to write what I consider to be funny, I'll assume that somebody thinks it's funny. And when the day comes that they don't, then I'll assume that I'm no longer funny. And that day will probably come. Most people who are funny get older and become less funny. It's happened in print, and it's happened with actors, and it's happened with screenwriters. They just, you know, you lose it at some point, and I'm sure that they will come. Hopefully it's not here for a while. But beyond that, you can, listen, if you want to block all the people who hate you on Twitter, you can go through life thinking that everyone loves you.
Yeah.
And I tend not to, you know, the best training I ever had for not taking anything seriously was for a couple of years at the National Post, I wrote about TV. I was a TV critic.
Yeah.
And the passion that people had for their TV shows and when you would criticize them, like, for a while it absolutely stunned me. And then it just kind of made me completely numb to the idea of criticism. You know, when I launched this book in Ottawa last month, I had an a cappella group basically perform a song made up of hate tweets. To me, it makes absolutely, it has no impact on me when people people write critical things about me, because I spent 2 years getting like letters in the mail from people saying, I'm an 11-year-old girl, and you made me cry because my daddy went to Halifax to work on that show, and you suck, and he's awesome. So I'm not even making that up. That was actually a letter I got.
Really?
So I don't know. I do think that if there, no matter what you write, everybody who is funny, Jon Stewart, the people at the very top of their game, there are people who hate them. There are people who think they're not funny. There are people who think they have an agenda. And if you want to kind of, you know, wade into the hate and feel bad about yourself, you can do that. And if you want to ignore that, you can do that too. And I kind of find a middle ground of I enjoy the hate and I enjoy the compliments that come as well.
So to your book, as I said in the introduction, it's a laugh-out-loud, funny book. One of the themes that you talk about, it's in the title of the book, you talk about the future. We always think of the future as bringing us great advancements, whether technological or cultural even. Yet, what I find is that the stuff itself doesn't get easier.
Yeah, it gets more complicated.
Yeah.
It takes up more time instead of less. That is, I mean, I'll be honest, the book, it's not exactly as though it hangs on some sort of revolutionary thesis. It's a bunch of jokes, and hopefully it's entertaining and
it
funny.
Is. Yeah.
But to the extent that there is a point, I guess the point is that I can remember as a boy, you know, I legitimately thought I'd grow up into a world of hover cars and robot butlers.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of what we were promised in terms of the future, and that really hasn't panned out at all. And instead, we're getting this weird kind of incremental progress for progress's sake. And maybe the part of the book that kind of hits on that the best is the notion of the connected home and all these appliances, where now you can watch TV in a refrigerator and you can get a text message from your dryer telling you your clothes are ready. And these companies, these global companies are investing, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, billions of dollars into developing this technology that I've never met a person who wants it. They might buy it in the end, but it's just this notion that we can make a dishwasher that tweets, so we shall, whether the human race needs it or any human demands it.
And I guess what's tied into that is that if they're selling it, we will buy it.
Whatever. Well, that's their theory. And it's proven true with most gadgets, hasn't it? I mean, I'm not so sure about a $3,000 refrigerator that tells you where you left, so you can program where you left your butter on the front, and you can always find your butter, and you can tell, you know, you can program how much milk is left, and your refrigerator will text you when you're running low on milk. This is like, who keeps their butter at the middle of the Minotaur's labyrinth? I know where my butter is. I don't really need to program into the screen of my refrigerator. So I'm not sure that in the end, and God only knows, the refrigerators break down enough as it is. What about adding, like, all these circuits and electronics? I just find that this is kind of the embodiment of where we are in terms of this weird incremental progress that is not actually progress of any tangible sort.
Yeah, and it'd be just even cars. Like, I don't drive, but I mean, when I hear of people with cars, ever since they put computers in them, they're not as reliable.
Yeah, I can attest to this. I am a sucker. I mean, I'm an early adopter of stuff. I've got things, like, do you remember the Newton? I don't know how old you are, Joe. How old are you?
I'm 32.
Okay. Do you remember, are you aware of the Newton?
No.
Okay, it was an Apple device from the 90s that was kind of a precursor in a weird way to the Palm Pilot.
And
it was kind of like this gigantic stone, gigantic electronic thing, and you could write a little memo to yourself in handwriting on the screen, and it would translate it to text, making about 80% of the words wrong and the rest of them spelled incorrectly. And I bought this thing, and it was a complete and utter disaster. And it continues on. I tend to move towards cars that have these, you know, the navigational systems and the satellite radio.
Yeah.
And 80% of the time I'm at the shop, it's not because the car won't work. It's because the radio won't work, or the wires won't work, or the navigation screwed up or something. So you're right. I mean, we add all these layers of so-called convenience, and it ends up making things less convenient.
And it cycles too, doesn't it? Because I mean, you mentioned this Newton thing. At one point, cell phones were very small. Now, cell phones tend to be rather big. Like, you look at that Samsung Galaxy thing; that's huge. The BlackBerry Passport. I mean, that's, you know, this bigger than one's shoe. I don't get that part of it.
It's funny. There's a whole era of humor that is will be inexplicable or not understandable to a generation now, where everybody made fun of how small cell phones were getting.
Like
you need a magnifying glass to find them, and we've ended up demanding the opposite because we want screens we can look at with ease from anywhere. I hadn't thought about that, and now I feel bad about not having thought about that. It should be in the book, for God's sake.
Well, you write another book, I guess.
Yeah, there we go. I'm starting to take notes right now.
If you think of people like, we mentioned Stephen Harper already, but I mean someone like Rob Ford, for a humorist like you, I mean, there's material, isn't there, in our politicians day in and day out. Will you miss someone like Rob Ford?
No, not at all. And I'll tell you what, the politicians and the topics that seem easiest to mock can sometimes be the most difficult in some way, to mock with some sort of, you know, originality or whatever. Because, okay, so first of all, everybody's making Rob Ford jokes, right?
Yeah.
And you have access to Twitter, and I write for an antiquated medium known as magazines. So I write on Monday morning for a thing that's going to appear Friday. And sometimes I just look at it and I go, I can't, you know, I wrote very few Rob Ford things in the end, probably three or four over that whole 18-month period, simply because I knew, A, it had to be really good, or, you know, people would stop reading a third of the way through because they'd heard better jokes on Twitter. And second of all, the story's advancing so quickly and changing so quickly that, you know, you can't really keep up with it in that way. And it's kind of the same with technology. It's kind of the most outrageous developments in technology, like everything from, like, fitness trackers for your dog that you put around their collar to the kind of serious stuff, like killer robots. It's sometimes that the stuff is so funny on its own and absurdist on its own that it's actually difficult to make it a topic that really works because the bar gets set very high for those things.
One thing that you do send up quite well in the book is the sort of politicians speak that we encounter in the press regularly. I mean, the political rhetoric is always high. The baffle gab that we get from politicians and that gets parroted by journalists and the sort. I mean, even the language. I mean, the stakes are high. We just came out of a municipal election here in Vancouver, which a lot of people said was the most important election ever. I'm assuming that the one in next fall federally will be the same.
Yeah, well, listen, I'm guilty as charged, though. I mean, I write about it and I mock it in the book, but when I was a political speechwriter, I don't think I was the one who coined, made Paul Martin say this is the most important election ever, but he said it, yeah. And I probably wrote it after that. You get caught up in, it's a powerful thing, you know, the whole, when you get into government and you see that side of it, the whole, just the way people talk and the acronyms they use and the way they write speeches, it's a hard thing to push back on because most of these people have been in politics. When you're dealing with the people at the top, these people have been in politics 20 years and it's the only language they know, really. So you can kind of encourage them and try to push them to speaking in new ways, but new ways are risky and new ways are unfamiliar. And it's much more easy to come out and say this is the most important election in history. Although I do make fun of it in the book, I am also guilty as charged. I'm having it both ways.
But people, I guess, are the average voter, if you will, we understand that, don't we? I mean,
I think we do. And yeah. I think that is the funniest thing is that people completely tune it out.
Yeah.
They don't take it. They don't believe it. They don't fall for it anymore. And so people are always coming up with, I guess, new ways to make people fall for stuff, whether it's through innovative kind of attack ads or micro-targeting of certain communities. There's just that kind of mainstream political rhetoric. It just sounds so ridiculous now. And, you know, but people keep saying it in the hopes that it's going to, you know, convince people. And people, I think it just goes right through their ears.
So for next year's election, which will be likely, but everyone will say this is the most important election ever.
I think it's undeniably the most important election in human history.
Yeah, exactly. So did you have any insight as to how that'll turn out, say?
No, I have to say I am genuinely curious. The last couple have been not as much fun to watch and not as much fun to follow. Long before I was a writer, somebody writes a humor column. I was a political junkie. I really loved just following it and kind of immersing myself in it and the personalities and all that. And this is, it feels like this is like an election like from my youth, where there were three genuinely interesting, flawed probably in some ways, but interesting and qualified candidates. And it feels like there's a genuine air of uncertainty, which I can't say was true for 2008 or 2011, and certainly not for 2006, the one we lost. Mm. So I think, you know, listen, people talk about, you know, luring people in and getting people back into paying attention to politics. On a day-to-day basis, that's super difficult, I think, because there's so many distractions. This election, truly, well, perhaps not the most important in human history, at least has the potential to be one that, that is interesting and does actually showcase some policy differences and presents an interesting choice for people. So hopefully that proves to be true, first of all. Second of all, people pay attention to it.
And unfortunately, for people to pay attention to it, I mean, the handlers will have to make these three leaders, oh, I don't know, more human, if you will.
Isn't that the worst?
Yeah.
Oh, God. Please stop making them human.
and these three guys are just the, I mean, I don't see that at all. You know, I can sort of see Justin Trudeau, you know, shake his head about so that his hair looks nice, and Thomas Mulcair maybe try to smile more, and the same with Mr. Harper. But I mean,
oh God, they do make him try to smile more, and it's actually terrifying.
Yeah, it is.
Smile less.
Yeah,
like he doesn't look. The thing it reminds me of, actually, when you talk about Mulcair, I did see him on doing a press conference, and he was smiling all the time. And you could, the only thing you thought the entire press conference was, they're making him smile. They're telling him to smile.
Yeah,
and it reminded me of the 2011 campaign where they made poor Michael Ignatieff go to Tim Hortons. And there's a photo of him you can find online of him carrying a box of Timbits out of the Tim Hortons. And he's carrying it in such a way, I really can't describe it, but he's kind of got it too high, and it's kind of like he's kind of holding onto it as though it's a box of nuclear waste.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's clear. You can look at that photo and say, this man has never held a box or seen a box of Timbits in his entire life. This thing is just obviously a fraud. And I think that most things that are designed to make politicians seem more human, just like anybody with even an ounce of sense, even if they don't pay attention to politics, just immediately go, yeah, that's fake. I mean, obviously that person is entirely uncomfortable doing what they're doing now. So I look forward to those only for the comedy, the inadvertent comedy. I'm the kind of guy, I can watch Curb Your Enthusiasm without changing the channel. I love the awkward, uncomfortable comedy, and any election provides some. This one has the potential to provide a lot.
Yeah, and so humor, is that something that leaders today, that they should use?
No. It's funny, for my day job, I write speeches for corporate executives mostly.
Uh-huh.
That's what I spend most of my time doing, and because of what I do for, I guess, at McLean's and that, people know me as a humorist, and they often will ask for jokes off the top of their speech and so forth, or to make a funny speech. And I really try to discourage them from doing it, because there's enough that can go wrong with a perfectly delivered good joke. There's a lot that can go wrong with a mediocre joke that's poorly delivered. And that the stuff that may sound great in the room doesn't come across so great in print, and then, you know, you've got shareholders wondering what's going on with the CEO. So I actively discourage most people, unless they truly have the gift for doing it, or there's just an obvious joke that, you know, is safe and smart. I find myself writing very few jokes for those people, and I think that's probably good advice for most politicians too. Generally speaking, when you hear about a politician telling a joke, it's usually in conjunction with an apology for having told the joke and a promise never to do that again.
Amongst your writing, the other stuff that you write, fiction, is that something that you'd be interested in doing?
Am I interested in doing it? I would love to have the ability to do it. I've never tried. I don't ever have an idea that to me seems like a fiction idea. I love reading books and admire people who can do it. Sometimes I'll study paragraphs in books and just go, like, how did he do that? Cormac McCarthy's The Road. I've read the last paragraph of that probably about 100 times. And I just can't. It's just so brilliant and so perfectly written. I can't even fathom attempting that same type of writing. If that sounds makes any sense to you, I don't know. It just seems like to write about fiction. You know, I write like 700 word pieces. If you're not interested in what I'm writing, you can flip over to the person who has died on the back page of McLean's, and you can end your you know your experience that way. to invest in, you know, 2 years or whatever it takes to write a book in something that literally could just be a steaming pile of crap, and most likely would be if I wrote it. I can't even bring myself to try, but I have to admit that other than being like a, I mean, I can't, there would be a, it would be an amazing thing to be, where, and to have the talent to do that. I know you interact with a lot of people who have that talent, and it makes me incredibly jealous.
But you'd like to, I'm sure, write like a sex scene in fiction, wouldn't you?
Oh, I do that all the time, but that's just my own enjoyment. That's for personal use. We just keep that by the bed.
The because you write about that in the book, about this. They give an award for the best bad sex
so, yeah,
fiction.
Oh, my God. Some of those are so, like, it's as though they're, yeah, there's the bad sex fiction award. And it's not just terrible writers. It's, like, top quality writers. Like, Norman Mailer was nominated 1 year, or maybe one. And it's just like they're trying to win this bad sex fiction award. And I guess maybe if you're Norman Mailer and you've written enough that you can afford to write a couple passages that are a little absurd and over the top. But yeah, I mean, that's a, that would be a fun award to win, I have to admit.
I interviewed
one of the Razzies as an actor.
Exactly. Yeah, I interviewed a writer who was nominated that year for it. And it was just before the award was coming out, so I asked him about it. And so we're talking about it, and I don't think, I think he was kind of serious about what he'd written. And so, you know, I thought this would be a great chance to, you know, and it just, it didn't work out as an interview that he eventually won the award, I should say.
Did he?
Yeah.
Oh, man, to be nominated for that, imagine, like, you can go to parties, and, like, sometimes I have nothing to say at a party, and nothing to talk about that's new in my life. If I was nominated for the best bad sex fiction, oh, you couldn't get me to stop talking.
Yeah, well, that's better than, like, an Order of Canada, I guess, right?
It would, honestly, given the choice between the two. I don't think that's, you know, going to be an option in my life, but given the choice, nominate me.
You're a political junkie, obviously, and the sense that I got in reading the book is that you're someone who's attuned to popular culture just as much. So I'm curious to know what you watch or consume television-wise. I mean, is it a lot of sitcoms? Is it stuff
it's
like
not
that?
It's hardly any sitcoms.
No, really?
I'll watch, trying to think of the sitcoms I watch. The mainstream sitcom I watch now is Brooklyn Nine-Nine, which I think is very well written. It's done by a bunch of very experienced TV people. It's got a tremendous cast, and it's got some reliable jokes. It reminds me a bit of 30 Rock in terms of being just a killer joke machine, you know? 30 Rock wasn't necessarily the greatest sitcom ever, and certainly the character development was pretty minimal and all that, but as a pure joke machine, it was hard to top for 4 or 5 years there. And I think that's where Brooklyn Nine-Nine is. I'm more into stuff like, I guess, Veep or The Thick of It from Britain, those kind of shows. And, I mean, that's the only kind of funny stuff I'll watch. Mostly I'll watch stuff like Game of Thrones and that. That's where my interests lie. And I think a lot of comedians or people who write humor tend not to watch too much of it themselves. I'm not sure necessarily why, maybe not to spoil stuff or to be influenced necessarily by something or to inadvertently repeat something. Or maybe they just want a break from that stuff and an escape to something else.
Like Jon Stewart or Colbert, do you watch those?
I did. I go through phases with them, and I think that's true probably of a lot of people. I DVR them. They're on my DVR all the time. Sometimes I'll sit there and watch three in a row. Sometimes I'll watch them religiously for 6 months, and then I'll stop watching for a couple of months. There's really no rhyme or reason to it. Part of it's just busyness in life, and part of it's just like anything, you need a break from it. I think that's why, you know, one of the great things about the way we watch TV now is that you can just binge watch a season, and then you get a break from it for like 8 or 9 months.
Yeah.
And then you can come back to it and be excited about coming back to it.
I guess we could, we should be able to binge watch politics, don't you think?
I mean, whether it's technologically feasible is a less interesting question, then who would want to do that?
Well, I would think that if you were able to shut it off for a while, it'd be more interesting.
Well, that might be true. Yes, if there's just a season, we'd get the summer completely off, or like it would go from September to May. That might be a good idea, actually.
Yeah. Well, this is such a fun book, Scott, and congratulations on it. I quite enjoyed it. Are you working on another book now, by the way?
Oh, God, no. Those
really?
Things take forever. God, it's Canada, too. It's like, if it all works out, I might make tens of dollars. So, it was really fun to do, and I'm happy I did it, but I can't see myself doing it again, except for the Bad Sex Award.
Yeah, well.
I'm going to go do right now.
Well, that's something to aim for, right?
Yeah. Thank you. Yes, I need a new goal.
Thanks for this, Scott.
Thank you very much, Joe. That was fun.
The book is called The Future and Why We Should Avoid It. It's from Douglas and McIntyre. Do get it. It's such a fun book, and you'll enjoy it, I'm sure. Scott Festchuk joined me on the line from Ottawa and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunton.